The month in review. Which stories in May mattered most to you? From ongoing gridlock in the legislature to how voting will be conducted in the upcoming primaries, it was another month of dynamic news in Maine. We saw a ruling on ranked choice voting. An oversight committee found the state's Office of Child and Family Services displayed poor job performance in a case of child abuse. And new figures show more Maine parents are opting out of vaccinations for their kids. In national news, a decision found public figures cannot block people from their social media sites, and changes to the massive farm bill could impact food stamp and after-school programs here in Maine. I'm Cindy Hahn. Join me as we dig deeper into these stories and more with our panel of newspaper editors. And of course, we'll want to hear from you. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Cindy Hahn, and this is Maine Calling. Another month and another whirlwind of important news stories to discuss. There's the decision regarding the use of ranked choice voting in the upcoming primaries. There's anticipation over a Medicaid expansion decision. Reaction to the GOP and Democratic state conventions, to name just a few of the news stories that we'll talk about on today's program. With me in the studio, Ben Bragdon. He's the editorial page editor for Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel and Central Maine Sunday. Greg Kesich is also in the studio with me. He's the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Susan Young. She's the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. As always, we want to hear from you. Which stories in May mattered most to you? Our phone number is 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. So I feel like this is sort of the deja vu month in review show, starting with legislative gridlock. When we did the show last month, the legislature had just adjourned, and we were waiting to see if there would be a special session or something to tackle the many issues left on the table. And now they finally met yesterday and made a teeny bit of progress, but there's still a lot left to be done, right, Susan? What is up with that?
Yeah, as you say, a teeny bit of progress. I don't think there were really high expectations when the Appropriations Committee announced that they were meeting yesterday, but they did approve some additional funding for county jails and raises for direct care workers, which is something that they had done in the last session but didn't fund. But other than that, big issues like funding for Medicaid expansion and tax conformity and a transportation bond remain in limbo. And given some of the comments yesterday and some of the continued disagreement and little bit of hot-headedness, doesn't look like they're any closer to resolving those big issues. So
how does that work?
I guess we just watch and wait.
For how long? Is it for another month?
Well, they have a problem because the fiscal year ends on June 30th. So they're going to have to at least act on some measures before then to have funding in place for some of the programs that they hadn't finalized for the upcoming fiscal year. But I don't know. Will things change after the primary because you have several members of the legislature running for governor and they probably won't be running anymore? I mean, I don't know. It doesn't look like there's a easy path out of this gridlock.
Do you guys see any path, Greg or Ben?
It's interesting. I mean, we've never seen this before, so it's hard to say what's going to happen next. Usually what happens at the end of a legislative session is people get kind of tired and they get, you know, grumpy and hungry and they want to go home. They're you know, tired. A lot of people are sleeping in motels and they work out deals. Usually, you know, the budget, the most common argument you hear people voting for the budget is, I don't like everything in here, but this we have to get our work done. And you've taken that element out. They've all gone home. You know, they've all gotten their rest.
They're
kind
hungry.
Of starting all over again. will they be able to pull it back together and get that sense of urgency before the end of the month? Probably not, but they'll probably get something done. You know, a lot of these things you won't feel them right away, like the school funding. You probably won't, you know, they won't immediately recognize the effect of this until later in the summer. So, you know, I think they still have some time. But the question is you know, as Susan said, you know, after the primary, what are the political motivations? You know, are they digging in for the fall election? There's a lot of blame going back and forth over which side is more to blame than the other. So I guess we're going to have to see what the forces are.
I still don't get, though, what the mechanism is for those unresolved issues. They just sit. I mean, there's no deadline, really.
No, except for the effects start to be felt.
Okay, that is the deadline,
you know, and people running for re-election might not want to, you know, go back to their school districts and say, oh, yeah, there's no money for you this year.
Right.
Yeah, there's going to be a lot of pressure around the school funding, and I would think there's going to be a lot of pressure around the transportation bond. Yeah. But, and there's really nothing to hold those up except for the kind of political fight that's going on. But, you know, what can change that dynamic, which just seems to be getting harder in the month that we left, you know, the left legislature, nothing changed. If anything, like Greg said, people got a little bit more stuck into their positions. I mean, they showed up yesterday afternoon for this meeting, and then it was delayed for hours upon hours, and it wasn't clear what they thought they were going to be able to accomplish because nothing had really changed from when, you know, they couldn't accomplish anything a month ago, except now they don't have really anything hanging over their head like the end of a session that to get them to move forward.
Okay, so one of the things... Go ahead, Susan.
There is an interesting development today with the governor speaking to the, I believe it was the Government Oversight Committee, on the report on DHHS's handling of child abuse, mm-hmm. that he did plan to propose legislation to improve the situation, and he would call a special session to deal with that issue. If he does call a special session, then a lot of these other issues will be brought up as well. But as both Greg and Ben pointed out, nothing's changed in terms of people's willingness to work together. But it does look like there might be a reason for lawmakers to be called into the State House this summer.
Okay. Since you brought that up, we did want to talk about that a little bit. So you were referring to the fact that the Oversight Committee, OPEGA, did issue a report, right, on the Office of Child and Family Services, that they displayed poor job performance, lack of supervision, and the death of one of the two abused girls. And there wasn't much more specificity than that, right? So I guess today's hearing was Governor LePage weighing in on that report.
Yeah, the report that came out, which cited, the medical confidentiality laws and the reason they couldn't discuss the cases specifically or in much detail at all, really just kind of said what needs to be fixed within the system, but it didn't say anything about how they came to those conclusions. It didn't go through each of the cases and say, you know, this is where mandatory reporting fell short, or this is where communication between, you know, law enforcement and the department fell short. And so we just don't know those details, so it's really hard to figure out what needs to be done. Today, the governor gave us a little bit more of an idea. He probably knows more than we do on these subjects, and he says that it's a problem that we favor family, you know, reunification, keeping the kid with their parents over other matters in these cases. He feels it should just be whatever's in the best interest of the kid. And he said that the computer system is too old and that it's too easy for red flags to be missed in the system, and that's what he wants to do. So he's working on legislation. As Susan said, he's going to bring that forward, and looks like they're going to handle that in a special session. But without knowing the specifics of what happened in those cases, it's kind of hard to make a judgment on those things.
Okay. And Susan, you also mentioned that one of the things that was sort of left as a mystery for now is the Medicaid expansion. Who wants to tackle what's happening with that right now? Greg, how about you? I'm calling on you. I'm
Did you see me you looking away? There is the people approved a referendum that made it state law for Maine to expand Medicaid to a broader population. The governor's position has been, I will expand it if you fund it at a rate that I believe is sustainable going into the future. And that's based on estimates from his own department that are grossly above what the other estimates, including the nonpartisan Office of Fiscal and Program Review estimate, would be. So, I mean, that's been the dispute all winter. The proponents of Medicaid expansion say that the money exists now. It's in the Medicaid account. If you were to spend this money, and it's, you know, it's a, I hesitate to use a figure because there's a million of them. They range from in the as low as 15 million to get it started up to 150 million. But the money exists not only in the current Medicaid account, but it's also we've received enough surplus funds that you could fund it at a very, at a worst case scenario, basically through the end of the year and fiscal year. And then the next legislature would be in charge of, you know, going forward. So that's sort of the dispute. And there is a lawsuit from advocates that is trying to force the state to spend the money. And the state is saying, the administration is saying, we can't spend the money unless we're authorized. But basically, they don't want to do it. And the Medicaid expansion funds were used as leverage by the House Republicans when the whole legislative session broke down. They were trying to get the Democrats to roll back the minimum wage increase, which was also passed by the people in 2016.
Familiar.
So yeah. It's a mess, and the money's there. What you're talking about is expanding eligibility to a program where people would have to apply and get accepted. So you need there's some administrative cost in getting them on the rolls. You're not going to get every single eligible person on the rolls August 1st. It's going to be something that grows over the course of the year. For every dollar you spend, you'll get nine plus back from the federal government or in addition to from the federal government. So there's a dispute about whether Maine can afford its share. You know, that's the kind of thing that's holding it up. But basically, you have a group of people in the administration and in the House side of the Republican caucus who just don't want it to happen.
So we're waiting on this ruling, right?
Right.
I mean, will that make a difference if they say you do have
I
to fund
suppose,
it?
I suppose the courts could, what's the Andrew Jackson line? He has his ruling, let the judge enforce it. You know, like, you know, basically.
me do it.
Can you make him spend the money? I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that as long as Paula Page is sitting in, the second floor of the Blaine House, I mean, or the State House, that there's not going to be Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm. It's important to note that Justice Michaela Murphy has already said, although she hasn't ruled, obviously, she did say during the hearing that Medicaid expansion is the law and it's not optional. So it is up to the administration to follow the law. As Greg said, will that happen? We don't know. But the judge was pretty clear that there's no question that this has to be done. So really what Republicans and the governor are doing are simply delaying it.
The judge also said that didn't seem like she really wanted to get involved in the legislative process either. So it's unclear to me what that decision is going to say and whether it'll force anybody to do anything. And it's also unclear. We have this spending bill that's at the heart of this disagreement in the legislature. And it's for a very small amount of money. It's what the Democrats say can get this started, but it's not anywhere near what the governor says he wants. So this bill that's at the heart of this conflict, even if the Democrats get it passed, it's unclear whether the governor will just say this isn't enough money, and then who knows. So I think, like Greg said, it's probably a. We're probably looking at we'll talk about this every month through next January.
Well, actually, there's another topic that we keep talking about every month, but we're going to do it again, is ranked choice voting. Now, there is a federal judge that turned down the Republican Party's request to bar ranked choice voting in the upcoming primary. Is that the end of that discussion, or are we definitely seeing it on our ballots on June 12th?
I can't think
of
it. Oh,
we are.
Yeah.
We are going to see it on the ballots because the ballots have already been printed.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we'll also see Max Lynn's name.
Right. Uh-huh.
But, you know, Republicans say that it infringes on their ability to run their, you know, their party business. But the state law says Republicans have to have a primary. I mean, this isn't something new. It's been on the books since 1911. And state law governs what a primary looks like. Republicans have the ability, Republican voters have the ability to just pick one mm-hmm. candidate, that rank a single person and vote like they always have. And they're, as a result, their, you know, election night results will be the final result.
Mm-hmm.
They also, I've noticed that, you know, for all four of the Republican candidates for governor are opposed to ranked choice voting and all say that they're against it being the law. I haven't heard any of them say that if I win under those in a ranked choice system, I won't accept
right.
it. You know, they could all do that. They could all say whoever wins the most votes on election night, first place votes, is the nominee. And if I'm selected, I'll step aside.
Hmm.
Yeah. And of course, on June 12th, we'll also vote on ranked choice voting, whether
right.
to keep
right.
ranked choice voting. And that's kind of interesting because it passed fairly narrow, wasn't it? It was like, yeah. And
within 5 points. I mean, it was you know, a typical
right.
referendum.
Yeah. And there's a very organized pro ranked choice voting group. They're the ones who have sought this through the entire process and have done well with that. But there's really no organized opposition except that for the last 3 months, we've been talking about related to ranked choice voting has been negative.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what that's going to do to the vote for ranked choice voting, because what, you know, if you turn on the news most nights, you're going to be hearing something bad about ranked choice voting or just something that just sounds like a whole lot of trouble for not much. So I wonder if that's going to, you know, play into the vote at all. I wonder if the people behind ranked choice voting are concerned that there's been so much negativity around it the last few months.
So you think, I mean, do you get a sense that voters do understand what they're supposed to do and are going to rank candidates?
Yeah, I hear a lot of kind of conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't fill out, you know, I heard somebody say, this was on Facebook, so who knows, but, you know, if you don't fill out, make sure you cross out the rest of your choices because they'll fill them in for you, or don't fill in, you know, make sure you fill them in because someone will add their second choice in, or if you only vote for one person, they'll throw your ballot out. I hear that
right,
a lot.
Right.
And so that might be an issue. I don't know.
Well, I do know that people need to be a little more informed if they're doing the ranking, and so I just have to say that mainpublic.org does have our Your Vote information about candidates on there, so I know I'm going to study that. We're going to take a quick break right now, so when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Rosemont Wellness Center, home of the baby lunch date, Mondays on Brighton Avenue in Portland, rosemontwellness.com.
On the next Fresh Air, former Vogue creative director and America's Next Top Model judge Andre Leontali describes how he went from a simple four-room house with no central heating in the Jim Crow South to the world of international fashion. Talley is the subject of the new documentary, The Gospel According to Andre. Join us.
Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. From bookstores to banks, restaurants to realtors, Maine Public Radio is supported by a wide variety of businesses and organizations. They understand the importance of Maine Public in our community, and their investment helps make this service possible. More information about business support is available at mainepublic.org. Click on support or give us a call at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. Together, we make Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical possible.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Today on the program, headline stories from the month of May. Joining me are Greg Kasich. He's the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald, Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon is editorial page editor for Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel and Central Maine Sunday. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Susan Young. She's the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. So we were talking about voting, and I know that both of you, are facing me at least, Greg and Ben, you're talking somewhat about the apathy. I don't know, is it your apathy or among voters about the upcoming primaries and the gubernatorial candidates? It's not quite the buzz that you were expecting.
Yeah, you know, and it's a chicken and egg thing. I know the campaigns blame the media for not covering it as extensively as we have in the past. I'm not sure that that's true, that we're not, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of candidates making news outside of, you know, profiles. It may have something to do with the way campaigns are run now. Like, there's a lot less time spent persuading people to vote a certain way, and a lot more sort of identifying your voters and making sure that they turn out.
Is that because of social media that you're targeting?
Well, yeah. I mean, we have a lot more information about each other than we ever did before. People don't watch TV the way they used to.
Right.
They have, you know, ability to target ads, you know, these Facebook ads in ways that, you know, were not necessarily available in the past. But I'm not really sure. I mean, I think, you know, the other thing is we know a lot about what stories people are reading. And you know, these politics stories are not, you know, the readers are not banging on us to, okay, now they will. If I say this, and Susan Young, if you contact Susan Young if you have any complaints about the media coverage. But you know, so I think there's a lot of things going on. But I just remembered in 2010 there was a real connection between the Maine governor's race and a mood going across the country about like anger and dissatisfaction with the way things were running. And it was getting channeled through candidates like Paula Page. And I don't really see anybody who has sort of captured that spirit of the moment so far.
What about you, Susan? What's the buzz on the gubernatorial candidates from your view?
I think you raise an important point about social media. I mean, as Greg said, campaigns are really trying to target specific audiences, specific people that they know will get out to vote. So a lot more energy has gone into reaching people that way rather than through the media. And also, as Greg said, I mean, candidate profiles, I think on one hand, they're an important public service, but they're nowhere among the top stories that our readers read, and even less so about campaign finance. Readers barely even pay attention to those stories. So I think it raises some really interesting questions for us, as well as the campaigns, about how you get that message out.
Okay, we'll take a caller now. We'll go to Jordan calling from Franklin. Hi, Jordan, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, greetings from Frenchman Bay down here. I have a question. Down here, it's largely a Republican area, and we're all sort of following the election closely. I'm wondering about the Republican Senate race. What exactly is going on with Max Flynn? We've heard weird allegations of corruption fake ballot petitions and everything else. So we're wondering, is he actually even on the ballot? Will a vote cast for Max Flynn count in the upcoming election? And what's going on with all of that? It seems like there's a story there, and I haven't seen it well reported.
What do you say, Ben?
Well, it's a weird situation because he is on the ballot. Because it was too late to remove his name from the ballot. However, any votes cast for him will not count because a judge said that he had not qualified for the ballot because of invalid signatures, including numerous signatures from voters who are dead. So it's an odd situation made even more bizarre by the fact that he's got campaign signs up and is sending out emails asking his supporters for money. So it's a very, very weird situation. But he is on the ballot, but if you vote for him, it will not count.
Right. And do you have to report those contributions to the the imaginary FEC that keeps track of candidacies that don't really exist. I mean, it looks like a campaign, but it isn't one.
Well, you know, and this all
And those are great questions.
Yeah.
Does he have to report? Can he spend money that he raised after a judge said he's not a valid candidate?
And this all started because he had a number of people on his ballots that were dead, or signed his petition that were dead. I've heard. I don't know if rumors is the right word, but there's an investigation into this, and I by the Attorney General's office, and I haven't seen anything about that. But the sheer number of bad signatures that were on those petitions to start, the ones that the reason he was kicked off the ballot is really, really problematic, and it was connected to petition gatherers who have had a lot of trouble in this state before, and who are responsible for some of the tactics that make give petition gathering a bad name. This probably isn't the last that we've heard of Max Lynn, either because there's some of this stuff that still is left to be resolved, or he just doesn't seem like the type of guy that will go away.
Mm. Okay, thanks for your question, Jordan. We'll go to another caller now. Todd in Hancock. Hi, Todd. You're on the line.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. A couple points on ranked choice voting. I've been voting for longer than I care to think. And to think that I can actually vote for who I want to without fear of thereby helping elect the worser of the two weevils. It seems to me like a real treat that I would think everybody would heart to.
So, Todd, have you mapped out then how you will rank? Did you kind of plan that out?
No, I haven't, but it seems simplicity itself to say, okay, although this is who I want, if I don't think they have a chance, then this is my second choice. I mean, that to me is simplicity itself.
Yeah.
My second point is I heard Mary Mayhew this morning essentially calling us voters idiots for even coming up with such an idea. And I think, as I say, I think it's so simple that to imply that we're idiots that can't even count to two or three is absurd. And so that takes care of the voting aspect. As far as the counting goes, I'm not up on that, but it seems like if people have trouble with it, they can get an 8-year-old to reprogram their computer.
Okay, thanks, Todd. Are any of you want to comment on the Mayhew mention there?
You know, most of the people I talk to, once they have ranked choice voting described to them or explained to them in very simple terms, because it is pretty simple, I think, then they get it. But it is new. It's completely different. And it seems like a pretty big change. When we were voting on this, it so much gets thrown into this because we're actually going to use it to vote and we're going to vote on it. So there's a lot of dynamics in there, and some of them, some of them make people criticize it for different reasons because of they're involved in this thing. I mean, but most likely, when we use ranked choice voting this time, you know, the person who's ahead on the first ballot will be the person that wins. I hate to see what happens if that doesn't happen.
Right, right. But there's this idea that you can go from like fifth or sixth place to first, and mm-hmm. and it's just that can't happen because you'll only be getting votes from people who have fewer votes than you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in fifth place, there's not a lot of votes beneath you.
Yeah, it's like a process of elimination that's kind of orderly.
But I think what Todd said about about how do you decide who to vote for in the 2014 gubernatorial race, we spent a lot of time talking about who was more electable, who could win between Elliot Cutler and Democrat Mike Mishu, and not a lot about the actual race between those two guys and the governor. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, in a perfect world, we would be talking about who would make the best governor and not so much try to game out, you know, what the polls are telling us. So I think that's, you know, that's how ranked choice voting can work. It's there's, you know, there's some lot of anxiety around, you know, whether it's going to come up with odd results. But I think, like Todd said, there's nothing simpler than this is my first choice. If I can't have my first choice, I want this.
Mm-hmm. You know. Okay. What about the second congressional district, the candidates vying there? Lucas St. Clair, I guess, he drew some criticism for appearing in an ad for Katahdin Woods and Waters. And what's happening with that seat or the search?
Just to be clear, on the ads, that was an outside group that mm-hmm. was running the ad. It wasn't the St. Clair campaign. And every election, we have this problem of these groups that don't have to report nearly as clearly as candidates and PACs do, that spend a lot of money either on behalf of a candidate or in opposition to another candidate. And the candidates then say, well, I can't coordinate with them. I can't do anything, which is true. But you can publicly and loudly denounce the ad mm-hmm. and say that you don't want these ads to continue. You don't want this group to either advocate on your behalf or beat up on your opponent. And so a lot of these issue advocacy ads, as one political consultant said to me, these are ads that are done unto you, and often nothing good comes of them. Even though right. they're trying to promote your candidacy, they end up hurting you. And it's interesting that a lot of the campaigns wish these ads would just go away. But since campaign spending is free speech, these groups have a lot of leeway to continue doing this, even though the people they think they're helping don't like them.
Can I ask Susan a question? You know, you're up there in the second district. Are we seeing a race kind of like the split in the Democratic Party between sort of traditional working class, I guess, you know, however you want to describe it, the, you know, Jared Golden representing sort of the Bernie Sanders wing of the party and Lucas St. Clair representing more of the, you know, environmentalist for lack of a better term, the Hillary Clinton party. Is that what's happening?
I really see it as a split between the establishment, which early on and in great numbers had lined up between behind Jared Golden, who had been in the race much longer, and then Lucas got in and was kind of an upstart. And frankly, a lot of the people in the establishment don't like that. They think this was Jared's race and Jared's seat, and that Lucas St. Clair shouldn't be involved. I mean, a lot of the comments on our endorsement and even on letters to the editor, you can see, frankly, a lot of anger from establishment Democrats, just really frustrated that Lucas is even in the race, and, you know, saying, well, all he ever did was create a national monument, as if that were easy and not a huge accomplishment. Or, you know, well, he's rich. Okay, but he wasn't born rich. His mom was a smart entrepreneur and, you know, had a lot of luck, and now they have a lot of money. So are we supposed to hold that against him? It's just kind of unfortunate that we're not seeing a lot of discussion of the issues, and it's more, I'd call it even character assassination coming from, you know, the hardcore long-term Democrats.
And what makes up the Democratic establishment now? Is it like the unions, elected
officials? The party, the unions, party leadership, elected leadership in the legislature, and then the longtime reliable Democratic donors, as mm-hmm. well as who I would, you know, I'll use the air quotes, would consider the establishment.
I'll just let you guys chat.
Okay, sorry.
No, actually, we'll just go ahead and go to a break now. But first, a word about tomorrow's show. Join host Jennifer Rooks for our annual Summer Reads show. She'll have a panel of well-known readers who will share the books they're most looking forward to curling up with this summer. Email your recommendations to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet us or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. Mercy Hospital, celebrating 100 years in Greater Portland, partnering with the community to deliver the next century of care. mercyhospital.org. And adventure-bound rafting, whitewater rafting, stand-up paddleboards, hiking and camping vacations for youth and families. adventureboundrafting.com.
The U.S. Navy is trying to attract a new generation of recruits and working to counter some old notions.
It's a popular misconception that oftentimes the military is the last hope for the kid that has nowhere else to go. And that's absolutely just not the truth.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Navy rolls out a new ad campaign aimed at young, tech-savvy recruits this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR's.
All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Between now and next Thursday, June 7th, Maine Public Radio will present a series of special Your Vote 2018 primary candidate profiles in our 2 o'clock hour. On June 12th, Maine voters will choose the Democratic candidate for the 2nd congressional seat and the Democratic and Republican nominees for governor. You can find all these conversations anytime online at mainepublic.org/yourvote. There, you'll also find our debates for on-demand viewing, our television and radio on-air debate schedule, and the latest election news. Today's Your Vote 2018 Candidate Profile program features Mary Mayhew, a Republican for governor, and Donna Dion, a Democrat for governor. That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the stories that made Maine headlines in May. Joining me are Greg Kesich. He's the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Ben Bragdon is editorial page editor for Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel and Central Maine Sunday. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Susan Young. She's the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-399-3566. And I'm going to go ahead and read a question on Facebook from Michael. This is actually for you guys on how you do your job. It says, you know what types of stories people are reading and who's reading them, and how much does this influence the types of articles you publish? Controversial pieces are more popular and interacted with. Could controversy affect measures of success you may typically weigh articles by? And how do you measure importance of news, if not by views? There's a lot there. Yeah. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, we're all on the editorial side. We're all on the opinion side. So what the decisions we make, I think, are more about what drives interaction, you know, what our readers want to talk about. There are... I can just say generally on the news side, look, nobody wants to write a story that that nobody's interested in. There are times when we need to do our jobs. We need to cover things that are not exciting, and but are important to get on the record. I think the way news moves online is it used to be we set the hierarchy. We said this is the biggest story of the day, and we're going to put it on page one on the in the upper left-hand corner, and everybody else would read that first. And that doesn't happen anymore. These stories fly around on their own. They're these kind of free agents. Even your stories, right? People don't necessarily. I'm talking about radio stories are shared through social media and email, and so that creates a second hierarchy. And I think we try to balance what people are already talking about, but a lot of times people don't know what they're interested in until it's happened. Mm-hmm. So we try to we're looking for those kind of stories too.
Yeah, I mean, we're always looking for what are people going to be talking about tomorrow, and what issues do they want to hear about, and what issues do they need more enlightenment about. And as Greg said, too, I think another thing that editorial pages can do now, you know, it used to be carry a lot more weight because the newspapers were bigger and all those sort of things. But one of the things we can do as editorial writers and editorial page editors is put put issues onto the page that we think should be getting more attention that maybe aren't, or points of view that should be getting more attention that people could hear and that will really help people make decision about what's going on in their communities. To the question about controversy, it's a tight line. I mean, I don't think we ever want to use controversy for controversy's sake. And you can tell when a writer is writing to be noticed, or you know. But it's a thin line between that and writing a piece that people want to read because mm-hmm. it's got a lot of heat to it. But I think at the end of the day, we want to bring things to the page that add to the conversation and that aren't just read because someone said something crazy.
You told me, Ben, that one of the topics that did catch people, probably because it is controversial, is vaccinations, and we didn't talk about that. So just wanted to hear any comments you have about the growing number of kindergartners in Maine who don't get vaccinated, more parents opting out. In fact, one of the highest numbers of opt-outs in the country here in Maine. Have you written about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that's going in the wrong direction. It's kind of inching up. And I think it went up from, you know, the number of kindergartners not getting vaccinations, I think, went up from 4% to 5% or something like that. It doesn't sound like a lot. But then you have these pockets of the state where it's 10, 15, 20% of the kids don't have their vaccinations. Which is a direct result of all the misinformation around vaccines and also the large number of vaccines you get now. Those two things together kind of make some people feel uneasy in the way that you can type vaccination danger into the internet and find a lot of stuff to convince you not to vaccinate your child. None of it's true. It's not backed by any science, but it's there. And it looks true to a lot of people. And if you're inclined to believe it, then you're going to. But the problem is if you have a pocket where a fifth of the kids aren't getting vaccinated who could be, you know, they're interacting with other kids. They're interacting with kids that have health problems. They're interacting with kids that are too young to have the vaccine. Then all of a sudden you have a whooping cough outbreak.
Yeah,
I mean, this is something we shouldn't have at this time.
I read third highest pertussis rate in the country.
You know, you have these short, you know, these small outbreaks in a preschool or in a school or a daycare or something like that. But, I mean, there was one a few years ago in California that, you know, took out a wide swath of the state. And, you know, that can happen. And the reason is because we're just not taking this, what should be just kind of an automatic, health direction for kids.
Okay, I'm going to switch gears again because we have a comment from a listener. If the legislators would get their act together on recreational marijuana, they could use the tax from it to fund the Medicare expansion. But I think Medicaid, right? Medicaid expansion. Yeah. Both issues that the people voted for 2 years ago. Is that even a doable thing?
I don't think the revenue from marijuana would equal what they're looking for Medicaid.
Plus, they want to use that for a few other things.
And and plus, you know, it's going to cost something for the state to police marijuana. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like all costs go away. You actually make it more complicated. I think I read that the most law enforcement money spent on drug-related crimes involves alcohol because there are so many laws. Who can have it? When they can have it? You know, who can't have it? So you're going to have some of that with marijuana. It's not going to be any panacea to the state budget.
Okay. We're going to go to a caller now. Orpheus, I think, in Castle Hill.
Yes.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, it has to do with voter registration. I here it is. We're coming up on the 12th of June, and I have seen nothing in the newspapers, nothing on TV, nothing on radio that says, this is what you need and where you go to register to vote. All I've heard is from people who already are registered, and it seems to me that it would actually benefit everybody if the newspapers and the TV stations and the radio stations put forth the effort to say, these are the documents. This is where you need to, and your voting date is coming up on this date. because a lot of people, they walk into the driver's license office and they're given a whole bunch of questions, but they don't really, they're just trying to get their license. Mm-hmm. And so they're more apt to say, no, I don't want to be bothered, and move on.
Okay, Orpheus, let's see what, do you have information in your papers, you think?
We have probably not enough. I mean, it's something that the parties usually do around election time. But you can basically go to any state office. You can register to vote in Maine right up to election day. You go show up at the polls and you can register there. You can go to your town office. You can go to any motor vehicle office or any other state office and fill out a card before then.
What it is I don't see a push by all of these media organizations to say, go ahead, register to vote.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Orpheus, that's what I'm concerned with.
Sure.
Thanks for making your point. We're going to go to an email, I believe, from Waterville. It says, here in Waterville, the mayoral recall and the divide in the town that it has revealed continues to preoccupy us, although coverage by the media has been sparse, except by the Morning Sentinel. I hope your panel will discuss this. This is from Sarah in Waterville.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly been at all the meetings. We've had reporters at the meetings. We've been covering it right along. So thank you for the shout-out to the Morning Sentinel. Rachel Ohm, our reporter up there, has been doing a great job with this, and Amy Calder. It is a hyper-local issue. I mean, it's certainly got hints of this larger kind of cultural battle that we've got going on. But after the initial shock of all this going back and forth, it's really turned into this super local issue where it's this kind of deep division politically in Waterville. It has to do with, Colby and the so-called elites that take that side, and then the people that have been in Waterville a long time who feel that they get the shaft a little bit, and then the mayor who has been kind of exploiting that division to get out of addressing his own poor behavior. Every council meeting now devolves into that. Mm-hmm. We've got this situation, we've all seen them, where no matter what issue it is, it follows that divide in town. Mm-hmm. So a couple more weeks left, and it'll be solved in one way or the other on June 12th. But it definitely is an interesting local Maine politics story.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have
was a really good explanation.
Thank you.
He summed it up in a nutshell.
I hope they're recording, because we all use it.
We have an email from Cliff that says, given DHH's failure to protect the very lives of two children under their purview, arguably thanks to program cuts demanded by LePage and implemented by Mayhew, it takes a special kind of insensitivity and gall to then run for governor. Is Mary Mayhew really a serious candidate? Anyone want to take a stab?
I would say she's a very serious candidate, and a lot of Republicans really like her message. I mean, when she talks about making government more efficient, and she talks about, how DHHS was always in crisis, which is true because it's just a huge department that's really hard to run. But when it was in crisis, they couldn't prioritize the people who are truly needy, children, seniors. And she can tell a very persuasive story. But at the same time, there have been a lot of very negative consequences, including likely even some deaths, from running a department focusing only on saving money and meeting some metrics. That's why this department is so hard to run, because you're dealing with the most vulnerable citizens in Maine who often can't advocate for themselves. So I think for people whose mindset is that government should be more efficient, that she has a very persuasive message. And most of the people who are concerned about helping the poor and children and the disabled, not trying to make this very overly simplistic, but those people tend to be more on the Democratic side. So I think she's a serious candidate with a message that resonates among her voters.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that's going to hurt her in the Republican primary in her record. I think it would be, if she's the nominee, it'll be a major general election source of debate.
Yeah, there's no better indication of the divide in the state than Mary Mayhew. I mean, she is saying, I ran DHHS for whatever, seven years. And to half the state, that's a recommendation. And to the other half, they're like our caller saying, how can she even show her face? So that's a deep divide about what's going on there. Deep people seeing the state in two entirely different ways.
Right. Well, actually, our last post that I'm going to read is actually referring to this sort of divide, or I guess it's talking about the gridlock we were discussing earlier. Steve on Facebook says, I don't think anything changes because there's no consequences for the behavior of the legislature or the Blaine House. There are no Reagan and O'Neill type statesmen or leaders like Margaret Chase, and compromise is seen as a bad word, which is also one of Mary Mayhew's messages, right? Compromise is a bad word.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bad word for enough House Republicans and for the governor to hold this all up. I think saying that both sides aren't looking for something, some sort of middle ground, is kind of missing. I get the general point. I mean, everyone can look at the system up in Augusta and just say, you know, throw them all out. But I think when you get down to the details, it's a little bit, is something else going on now. I think probably Garrett Mason would make the argument that there's a little something going on there.
When you look at the four caucuses in the state house, you have the Republican Senate, which is they control, and the Democratic minority, and the Democratic majority, which is very slight majority in the House, and the Republican minority. There's like three caucuses on the same page, and they are have been able to find middle ground and compromised on, you know, great many more issues than any of us can name. There is just enough leverage for the House minority to throw the brakes on whenever the governor wants them to do it, and they do it. Mm. And it gives them the ability to get more than they would have gotten if they had just all voted their conscience and let things, let things pass by majority.
All right, that's going to be the final word for today's show. Susan, Ben, and Greg, thank you as always for joining us today. Susan Young is with the Bangor Daily News. Ben Bragdon is with the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel and Central Maine Sunday. Greg Kessich is the editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today, and we had additional help from Rich Tozier in our Bangor studio. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again at 8. Tomorrow on the program, ideas on books to read this summer. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.